Community Conversations with Community Centres SA. Here's Kerry Ackermans.
At some stage in life, we will all experience a major loss, and the resultant grief that follows is often not handled well by the person experiencing the grief and their network of support around them. Long after the grief is still biting in hard, people have moved on. That loss can come in many forms, not just from the death of a loved one, but from losing a treasured pet, financial, health, relational loss, even in migration when people move to another country. Today we're going to be talking about death of a loved one with Bec Brown, Spiritual Care Chaplain of the Royal Adelaide Hospital. Welcome, Bec.
Hi, Kerry. Lovely to be here.
Bec, can you just talk to us about your role at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, which I'm sure you see a lot of loss and grief?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I'm one of the spiritual care chaplains there. There's about five of us in our team at the Royal Adelaide. And our role really varies. I guess coming from the understanding that we are, you know, human beings, a mind, body, spirit. And obviously if you're in hospital, there's something going on with your body that needs attention, but we're not just our bodies. So we pay attention to people's minds and spirits, and probably some of the few people in the hospital that have the time to just sit and listen to what's going on for people, particularly at end of life. That's a time when a lot of things are coming up. There's a lot of processing being done by families and the patients themselves. And so, yeah, I feel very privileged that we get to sit and just to help them process that. Might be regrets they've had through their life. It might be just coming to terms with their diagnosis. It might be just really what matters most to them and wanting to lean into that. So,
and I can imagine, Bec, that being the Royal Adelaide Hospital, that you see a whole spectrum, right, from where it happens in an urgent critical situation through to people know and have a period of time. Are there differences in that experience of loss and grief?
Yeah, absolutely. One of our chaplains is part of the palliative care multi-D team. So every week she goes to the meeting with the palliative care team and sort of work out who's receiving palliative care. And then we offer our services and our support to those patients and their families. And that's often, not always, but often can be a more drawn out diagnosis that sort of we get to journey with that person for a while. But like I said, not always. Sometimes you might only meet that patient once. But that meeting is really significant, and often we're there to really support their families at that time too, and helping them come to terms with that loss. That's very different to being called to ICU where there's been a car accident or something like that, and quite traumatic death. And that can be, yeah, as you can imagine, very traumatic for the family members. And again, often our support is really for the family members who are just in a state of absolute shock.
And would it be fair to say, Bec, that although it's the ultimate end for all of us, it's not something we prepare for or want to think about in our society, is it?
Absolutely. I think our culture is really poor at talking about not just death, but just dying. And, you know, I had one patient once who said, no, dying's not an option. And I felt like saying, well, it's actually the only option for all of us. And, you know, so many other cultures have rituals that support the process of dying and grieving when someone has died. But our culture, we just want to sort of push it away as far as we can and not think about it, not talk about it. And I find that with families or people who do that, it makes that end stage really even more difficult because they just don't have the language, they don't have any of the tools to actually navigate them through that time. So that's something, I guess, that where we come in and we try and help them to develop some of those tools and just really open it up and say, this is, you know, nothing's off the table. We can talk about anything here. But I've had patients that right up until the end don't want to acknowledge that it is the end. And that's, you know, we have to respect that, and we do, but it does make it, I think, even more challenging for family.
Of course it does. And it's not something that we practice or that we want to practice, is it? And when you think about it, it's one of those things that a lot of people just push away out of their mind. And so when the time comes, everyone defaults to their personality, their experience, their own personal journey, might be spiritual, could be something that they've taken from a specific religious belief. So it's not like you're getting to deal with one circumstance, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, every death is different. It's like birth, you know, there's a process that can follow certain similarities with, like in labour, with dying, but every death is really unique and really different. But yeah, I think people, they just don't, like I said before, just don't have the language. It's something, I think the unknown of it is what is, I find often what just terrifies people. They just don't know, well, firstly, the process, how the death's going to be. There's a lot of fear around, is it going to be painful? But then what happens after? And no one knows, right? It's a mystery. You know, being spiritual care, we work with a lot of patients who do have a form of faith or spirituality. Not always. I mean, we work with everyone. But I find sometimes those patients do tend to have a little bit more peace around the death because there is that sense that there is something afterwards. But saying that, I was with a patient yesterday who's a very strong Christian, and they were terrified. They just were like, now that they're facing it, they said, I just don't know. And that's, you know, totally understandable.
And it's that forever and finality that I think disturbs and worries people so much that they push aside, and how can they deal with that? So having said that then, it becomes that very awkward conversation, doesn't it, where people just think, do I never mention the person again? Do we not talk about them? Do we talk about them?
Mm.
And often people say, aren't you over it yet?
Oh.
You never get over someone, because if they were important to you, I think the Queen said it best, to love is to grieve. If you love someone, you will grieve if you outlive them.
Yeah.
And that is just it. And so everyone's going to go through this at some time if they survive someone that they love.
Mm.
And therefore, you don't want to forget them. You don't want to not talk about them. But often people won't discuss it with you and don't bring it up. And therefore, that person's even more forgotten. What did their life mean? What was the purpose?
Absolutely. Yeah, grief is the flip side of love. I totally agree with that. I think having had my own experience of grief, I lost my dad. He had a sudden heart attack about 10 years ago. And then my brother about 3 years ago. I am able to share. Like for me, I found something that I thought was just going to, that was it, that was final. And of course, in one sense it is, you don't get to sort of hear their voice and, you know, feel their warm embrace and those sorts of things. But what I found is that they actually are still with me in a different way, and being able to, you know, just if I'm struggling with a decision or something and I close my eyes, I can hear what my dad would say, because I had it for 37 years. That doesn't just go away. And so to be able to share that with patients and say, you know, death cannot separate love, that continues, it just looks different. And it's not the same. And there is grief, of course, in losing the human person that you loved, but it continues just in a different way. And I run grief retreats for people who are grieving. And that's one of the things I found really powerful, is being able to share, like you said before, share the stories of the person that we've lost, that we love, that we miss, tell other people about them, about what we loved about them. And it's just a beautiful thing. And people, I've had many people come on those retreats and say, that's the first time I've been able to talk about my loved ones since they died, like really talk about them. And I thought, what a gift, because you're right. People say, oh, I don't want to bring it up, I don't want to upset them. Well, we're thinking about them always. It doesn't, you know.
Well, it was interesting too, Beck. I spoke to a group of nurses actually in a situation the other day, and I asked them who was their mentor, their role model, who they looked up to. And all bar one, there was a group of 20, mentioned a family member that they still here, don't want to lose, or they had lost. Now, isn't that interesting that it would come down to someone they love, not an external famous person, but someone that they really love. And it's these stories and memories and influence that, if that lives on, it helps give peace to the living.
Absolutely.
But it's something that we're not good at doing, and we think, oh, it's best I just don't mention it.
Mm.
So how well would you say we do handle loss and grief in the community?
I think we've got a very long way to go. I think it is changing. I think now that I've moved into this space, and like I said, I run grief retreats, I'm running a recharge day for staff who work in palliative care and end-of-life care in a few weeks, my eyes have been opened that there is actually quite a lot happening in that space, but I definitely think that more could be done. And I think especially not immediate, because immediately after, people are really raw, and most people, not everyone, but most people sort of withdraw socially. They sort of go inside and just need that time to sort of process what's happened. So it's often a few months later, or sometimes even a year or more, that people actually are really ready to look outside and look for those support networks. And often I find them saying, I just don't know where to start. So things like, community centres where they can actually go to their local community centre and find, be part of a group that's able to lean into their grief and their experience, I think is so needed. Things like, I mean, I started my grief retreat because I was looking for something myself, and when my brother died and there was nothing. So I thought, well, I better start one. And I've just found there's been so much interest in that, because there's just not a lot of those sorts of things around, the sort of face-to-face. There's some fantastic things like Griefline, you know, 24/7 phone calls you can ring, and there's a fantastic podcast called Good Morning, and there's things opening up like that online. And of course, there's grief counsellors that you can go to. But for those sort of, find the group work where you're with other people who just get it, that's what we're missing, I think.
And that's exactly how we met, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Beck, I was introduced to Nancy, who works for the spiritual care team, who we will be interviewing down the track, because it occurred to me that there isn't somewhere to go and generally handle grief. And grief isn't just coming from the death of a loved one. Loss can happen in many ways to trigger grief, and that could be from a pet, it can be from relational loss, health loss, financial loss, yeah. and it triggers that grief. And in fact, for people who have that trigger, if they do lose a loved one, it's even worse because they haven't handled their own grief, so they really don't want to be dealing with somebody else's.
Yeah.
And this is why Community Centres SA are developing a grief and loss program, of which the Royal Adelaide Hospital will be an integral part of co-designing that with us, which we plan to run in community centres, as you know, Beck. The idea being based a bit on the AA model, where you have a support group, is you can actually come and share with someone who will hold that space. Mm. People don't want answers or platitudes. They just want you to hold that space
Definitely.
For them to share where they are at. And there'll be some information, video interviews, a few activities, but it'll be place-based. You can go to a local centre and find other people who've experienced what you've experienced. And grief is one of the few things that we will all share in life at some stage.
That's right. Yeah, it's so important. I remember I was running a grief group with some students when I was a school counsellor a few years back, and all of the students had lost a loved one, one of their family members. And after a few weeks, I said to the girls, what should we call ourselves? We need a name. What should we call ourselves? They said, we should be the Get It Girls because we just get grief. And I thought that was
That's
so gorgeous.
Great.
And I think that thing of just, yeah, you get it. You know, every experience is different, and yet though there's that. I mean, I studied grief. I was, you know, a grief counsellor. I thought I knew grief. And then my dad died. I went, oh, okay.
No, but it's your grief.
That's right. It's totally
different. People say, I understand. No, you don't. Yeah. And do you also find it's a bit of a competition? People start saying, oh, as soon as you share something, someone will automatically go, oh, yes, I know. I lost my dad. I lost this. And people don't want your comparison with their experience right then and there.
Absolutely.
And interesting you mentioned Beck about, and I'm talking to Beck Brown, who's spiritual care chaplain from the Royal Adelaide Hospital in this podcast episode. Interesting you talked about people socially isolate. Now, we know that social isolation is currently being touted as being worse than smoking, impact and ramifications in society today, particularly on individuals, and it leads to loneliness. Mm. Now, people withdraw as well because they can't find anybody who can help them. And they don't want to deal with anybody who won't help them. Mm. They would rather withdraw. Now, if they don't get moved along that journey, and I've talked to medical professionals about this, Beck, and I'm interested in your opinion, they can then develop mental health conditions such as anxiety, depression, which can spiral into a very serious condition. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, complicated grief is a real thing, and it can affect people's ability to function and to live a healthy life. Like you said, that withdrawing from society, shutting down emotionally, just not being able to do the day-to-day things. So if they're not getting that help and actually being able to work through it in a healthy way, it can absolutely manifest in all sorts of unhealthy ways in terms of, you know, negatively impacting their mental health. And we see that at the hospital. Obviously, we work with all patients across the whole hospital, so some of our patients do have mental health illness, and some of it does stem from really complicated traumatic deaths that just haven't been processed well.
And a grief and loss program that you can access in the community that is broadly general, because if someone is experiencing something that has gone into a more serious condition, then the plan is to refer out.
Absolutely.
But for some people, if you get in early and get that support, and they can then let family members know and colleagues in their network, this is how I want you to support me. They can actually voice it. Or give them a fact sheet. You want to help me read this?
Yeah.
And then you'll know that not to shut me down, don't compare.
Absolutely. And money is a factor too. I mean, we've got many people that I've worked with who's, when we talk about getting a grief counsellor, they're like, there's no way I could afford that. So to be able to have something in a community centre that's accessible for all, I think's just, yeah. Brilliant.
That's good to hear, because it's something that we've canvassed our community centres, and indeed we work with the Department of Human Services on other programs around supporting those of disadvantage and can't access that help or may have already isolated themselves.
Mm.
And major loss can be a trigger, the grief, and then that social isolation and loneliness, and then mental health condition. So, Beck, why do you think people don't address it though? Is it the fear of death themselves? Does it bring up for themselves what they may one day, well, they will face?
Yeah, I think, like I said, the absolute unknown of it. We're pretty good at living like we're in control most of the time.
Living like you have forever.
And, you know, there's certain elements we can control. But when it comes to our health and obviously when our death, the time of our death comes, that's totally out of our control. And I think that absolutely freaks people out, that that's just something they have no control over. And the unknown of, like I said, the actual process, how the death's going to be. I had a patient last week whose father was really struggling to breathe, which often happens at the end of life. There can be, you might have heard the death rattle and that sort of that. And they were really distressed by this. And so to be able to say this is actually quite normal, a lot of people at the end of life have this kind of breathing. There's actually a brilliant palliative care doctor from the UK called Catherine Mannix. She's written a great book with the end in mind, and she has a little 5-minute video called Dying for Beginners that you can just download for free. And she talks through the process, particularly if someone's under palliative care. So obviously it's not for all people who are dying, but it really helped them, this family. I was able to share that with them, and they said, oh, straight away I just feel less anxious knowing that this is something you've seen before, that this isn't, dad's not in pain. And so I think it's just, yeah, the unknowns, and we make assumptions, and then I think the big thing is afterwards, you know, and what is our life, you know, is that it? I've had a lot of patients who say to me, is this it? Is this what my life has come to? You know, haven't achieved all the things that they wanted to do, or yeah.
And they're getting reflection time.
Absolutely.
As against, we've seen a sadly recent situation of a mass death situation with, and the grief that the community is experiencing, and people just want to talk about that could have been me.
Yeah.
In any of those situations where there is a public death situation or something where it is accidental or precarious, that is where people just think through it all. Where there isn't any time to reflect.
Yeah.
But their loved ones do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And ruminate on that. If this situation hadn't occurred to lead to that sliding doors. There's a lot to unpack in that, to talk about, to share. And when that's pushed down, what does that do to people?
Oh, I think you can get really stuck, you know, that rumination, just going around and around something that you can't change. You have no power to change that situation. And yet your mind just keeps going over and over and over it. And you can, really spiral into quite a deep depression sometimes. I was going to say, just from what you were saying, the other thing we see sometimes is survivor guilt too, if it's been an accident or something like that, and maybe one person, the accident's passed and the other one hasn't, and just trying to make sense of that, and why did they die, why I didn't die, and all of those things. I mean, we see it all in the hospital.
There were countless stories from the Twin Towers attack of people saying, that could be me, I didn't go to work today, and many other stories. So, Bec, the program we're talking about doing with community centres, the value of that in humans, that rising above, how as a group we can achieve so much. And we see it often, don't we? But alone, it seems almost an impossible task to get past.
Yeah. I think just being part of a collective of people that understand, who have been through something similar, who don't give you the empty placards or, you know, well, at least you had them for that. You know, those things that actually don't help.
Oh, well, at least they got to 90 or whatever it might be.
That's
or
right.
At least
they had a good life. And I mean, often I say the longer you've had someone, the more there is to grieve. So, you know,
exactly.
The fact that someone's lived to 90 is...
And Bec, when you look at the statistics and we look at for pets, you know, 85% of people grieve their pet, and often that's totally unrecognised. But for some people, they are their life companion. Okay. 1 in 5 women experience miscarriage. That's something, oh, well, you'll have another one. Oh, this, oh, well, those two words, oh, well.
So unhelpful.
Cover. So unhelpful, and are meant to cover what they actually don't. So, Bec, in your time, you must have seen human nature at its best and its worst.
I have. Yeah, mostly its best. I think what really matters rises to the surface when you're facing your death. And often, you know, that's a question I ask a lot to people, is what matters most to you in the time that you have left? Like, what's really coming up for you? And almost, I'd say probably 90% of the time it's family, which is no surprise. But some of those relationships that might have been a bit tense, or there's been a breakdown in that relationship, there's a real desire to try and put that right and reconcile. And I've seen some beautiful, reconciliations between family members that probably wouldn't have happened, but they're able to die with that sense of peace that, you know, they were able to put that relationship right. I'm just thinking of a few examples that I've seen of sort of the best of human nature. And just families coming together, and just I can walk into a room and I say, oh, I can feel the love in this room. It's so palpable. It's so strong. And that's just a beautiful thing to bear witness to.
And really interesting, as you're talking, Bec, I was just thinking about, you know, what really matters. There was a book written, The 5 Regrets of the Dying, and it certainly wasn't that they'd missed a meeting. It certainly wasn't that, oh, well, I'm so glad I missed out on all those family celebrations. And these are the things it comes back to, that it also helps you reflect on your own life. So it can be very positive in how you live the rest of your life, that don't sweat the small stuff, and how important money is at the time, but completely irrelevant at the end of time, of your time.
Yeah.
And I think that's that thing, if we can also get these messages across, that don't wait to reconcile, don't wait until you have minutes left.
Absolutely. And just really, I know it sounds cliche, but the moment that you do have, I mean, I'd give anything to have another day with my dad or my brother, but the time that we did have, I felt like we really made it count. And I'm so relieved that I could say there's nothing I sort of regret. You know, there's nothing I wish like I knew absolutely know that that we'd said everything we needed to say. And the comfort I take in that and an element of peace from that, you're totally right.
And I think giving the tools to those who want to support people in grief, because they honestly do mean well. I mean, goodness knows how many tuna casseroles have been cooked over the years.
Lasagnas,
that's another one. Dropped the door. Oh, I've done something. I popped over a lasagna and the person sadly puts yet another one in the freezer. And what they really would like is for that person to sit and hold the space and just listen. And you might have to listen to that story over and over and over again. Mm. Is that a thing, Beck, where people, it helps to just get it out? Because after a while, the sting can go if you get the opportunity to keep sharing the story.
I mean, obviously it's going to be different for everyone, but I think you're right. I mean, at the beginning, everyone's sort of coming to you. You sort of shut down and withdraw off, and everyone's sort of coming and bringing food and are sort of there. I know for me, I didn't really want to talk at the beginning. I was too, it was too raw, I was too vulnerable, felt so fragile. But after a few weeks, few months, yes, I just desperately wanted someone just to sit and listen, not to try and fix it or make it better, or but just to hold space and listen. And that's what, you know, we do in our role in the hospital. And I think that's the potential of these community groups. When people are ready, when they're sort of able to sort of look out, because often what happens is all of those people that brought all the meals and we're calling up and dropping in, that'll, they go back to work, life goes on, we've had the funeral, you know, and you're just left. And that can actually be sometimes the hardest part, because the beginning is you're running on adrenaline. There's so much to organise with the funeral and paperwork and all of that stuff. And then give it a few months and suddenly the reality of the situation, you know, really becomes real. And
that's so interesting you say that, because people have a big thing about being seen at a funeral to show that they paid their respects. And for a lot of the people who have the family member, it's a blur.
Mm.
But the person who contacts 3 months later and saying, how are you going? Shall I come round and we'll just have a cup
that's
of tea?
Right.
That's often more productive than being at the funeral, which is, and sadly these days with social media, I did have a friend whose father passed away and everyone was putting all the tributes on Facebook, which takes a nanosecond and isn't very difficult. And I wasn't able to get to that funeral because I was away, but I actually went and visited her. I took her a favourite bottle of wine and said, let's just sit down, let's be here. But I did have somebody actually comment on Facebook saying, I was so surprised not to see Kerry make a comment. And I share that story because isn't that sad that that's what people are thinking about, that it's like, oh, I was on the board, I was on the list, I made my comment. Seriously? 2 minutes?
And like you said, for the person who's the griever,
they're not even,
it's like an out-of-body experience often.
It is. The day, that's why they get you to have the that ending, so that that's that part where you're still in that denial, shock, it's all that blur. It's the afterwards that the anger might come, the need to find peace with it and acceptance. And that's when you need people to listen, and they've long gone.
That's right. And we just don't have those sort of rituals that a lot of other cultures have to help them through that process afterwards. You know, a lot of cultures might be that they wear black for 100 days or
they have a ceremony 100 days after a year.
That's right. We don't do that. It's like you've had your funeral and now it's back to work and, you know, like you said, let's move on. I hate that expression.
It's terrible.
You just got to move on. You never move on. You just learn to live with it. And that can take, you
learn to live around the grief, but you don't want to get past that person. Someone said to me that you die twice. You die when you die, and you die the last time your name is ever spoken on this earth. It's a really interesting saying, which is why humans push so hard to leave a legacy.
Yeah.
Because then their name will. But when you think about it, there's not many who in 100 years' time, besides maybe if their story is told, which is why people tracing ancestry or looking back. But beyond that, to reach a public figure to the point of life, you said to people, name, you know, five people, you'll get the Abraham Lincoln, Mother Teresa, Dalai Lama, you know, the whole Gandhi, that's the list you'll get. Name someone that you just know from, I don't know, you put on the spot.
I think legacy is a really interesting thing. And I know so David Kessler, who co-wrote On Death and Dying with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, his was the sixth stage of grief, which is finding meaning. And I found that really integral in my grief journey of wanting to do something tangible to show the world this person lived, they mattered. So actually the little library that's here at Glendale Community Centre is in honour of my dad. And we had that done not long after he died. He loved books and we grew up here in this suburb. So it was a fitting place to come to our local community centre, and the men's club helped to build it. And it was just this beautiful community project.
That's a great
project. But we also made he walked the Hyson Trail. And so we made a bench on the Hyson Trail for people that they can just sit. And it's got his name and the years that he lived, and it just encourages you to stop and listen to the bird songs and the things that he loved. And just knowing that that's out there brings me some comfort, that there is a sense of legacy from his life. And I think it's really, really important for people. It's often can be a really cathartic part of the healing process to find those things that give meaning, not to the death, but to the life.
And you know, Beck, sometimes that takes a long time to come out. Two stories I can share about that. I caught up with a gentleman who was a professor, and he had come back to Australia because his mother passed away 20 years ago, but he hadn't been home for a really long time. And it wasn't until now, and he was listening to a session with Peter Gerz, who talked about his parents passing and grief and different. And I went out to him afterwards and actually talked about this program, and he got really upset saying, you know, you're the first person I've been able to talk to about my mother, because 20 years ago, no one wanted to know. I just came back for the funeral, but he wanted to share his sadness of not having been there.
Of
and
course.
He needed to get that out, and it just sat with him. So that really resonated with me. And from my own perspective, why I've got so passionate about that is I lost both my parents within 1 year of each other and was going through other issues in my life. And I've got a gorgeous little dog called Fudge, and I had her for 16 years, and she just passed away. And I realised that I had pushed down and pushed away all of that grief, and it all came all the way back. And it made me think about all that unresolved grief that people do push down because society expects us of us. At that time, I had young family to care for, and it all came back. So it doesn't actually go away.
No.
And it takes a trigger. And I thought, what is there? Which started me on the journey, like you, of looking at this and having the privilege of being with community centres. I felt that this was the place we could really get this program up and running.
Yeah, I was so pleased to hear when Nancy told me that you were doing it. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I often see grief as, you know, you've probably heard the metaphor before, but like a scar or like a wound, really. And when you first lose someone, it's like an open wound that's gushing with blood and just needing that time and attention. And but over time, it heals up, but the skin's never the same again. It's, you know, you've got a scar there and it's to remind you, but it's also the skin itself is quite raw. And sometimes, you know, something can touch it and it really hurts and it sort of comes it right back. So it can be years later and then something will just, I mean, it's been 10 years this year with my dad, and just the other day something just reminded me of him and I just instantly burst out crying. And
a song,
yeah,
a story.
that's right
and it bites you so hard. It's actually that very deep human emotion that you actually can't stop, and that's when it's authentic and real, and you know it's still there. I'm not saying to get over it, but that absolute bite. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Beck, this has been wonderful to have you on the program. We will have you and your team involved in this program, and we will interview others about it. It's a really important topic. We'd love to get your feedback about it to Community Centres SA, info@communitycentressa.asn.au, if you can let us know what that is. But thank you for coming today, Beck Brown, Spiritual Care Chaplain. It has definitely been our pleasure.
Thank you, Kerry. It's been a pleasure to be here. All the best with the program. I can't wait
look
to
forward to
you
working on it with us.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. These podcasts bring you stories from across the state of South Australia, all of the great work being done in our communities, and general topics of community interest. Feel free to share these podcasts with your networks and send us any feedback to info@communitycentressa.asn.au.
Community Conversations. For more information, check out communitycentressa.asn.au.